Welcome to the Sustainable Nano Podcast. I'm your host, Miriam Krause. In this episode, we get a sort of two-for-one deal. Chemist Margaret Schott of Northwestern University tells us a bit about her own work and career, but she also gives us a profile of Catherine Burr Blodgett, who was a nanoscientist before there even was such a thing. Seriously, I looked it up. Google Ngram has the first instance of nanoscientist occurring in 1994. Our interviewer this episode is Liz Laudadio, who you may remember from our earlier episode about Dr. Gru Harlan Brundtland. Liz is a chemistry doctoral student at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and a trainee in the Center for Sustainable Nanotechnology, which produces our podcast. Just a bit of context here before we get started. You'll hear Liz and Dr. Schott talk about the ACS, that's the American Chemical Society, which hosts conferences every year in which scientists present about their work. We were inspired to interview Dr. Schott because she did a history presentation at an ACS meeting where she talked about Dr. Blodgett, and you'll hear more about that in the interview. So without further ado, here is Liz Laudadio interviewing Dr. Margaret Schott.
So I have Peggy Schott here with us today, and she's going to talk to us about how she got interested in the history division of ACS, as well as her own journey in science. So hi, Peggy. Thank you so much for being here today.
Hi, Liz. I'm glad to be here with you. Looking forward to it.
Absolutely. So why don't we start off if you just want to tell us a little bit about yourself, kind of what you do.
So, Liz, I've been here at Northwestern University for close to 10 years. I'm the assistant to Professor Fraser Stoddart in the chemistry department at Northwestern University. He also happens to be a knight. He's Sir Fraser Stoddart, knighted by the Queen of England in 2007. In any event, I help him with anything along the administrative line, anything to do with computers and websites, scientific manuscript editing, and the ordering of chemicals, and many other things. You could say I do everything from A to Z. I also help to manage the research group of about 35 young people, and that's a fun part of my job. Professor Stoddart and I both joined the department in January of 2008, and for me, it was my second time at Northwestern because I also did my PhD work here, and I finished my degree in 1982. So it's been nice to be back, and I've enjoyed working alongside some of the same professors that I had as a graduate student.
Yeah, well, that sounds very exciting, and it must have been really exciting for everyone when you got the Nobel announcement last year.
When Professor Stoddart found out that he won a Nobel Prize in Chemistry, our lives changed dramatically after that time because he was in demand as a speaker and lecturer all over the world. In addition, he went to Stockholm for the Nobel Week and for all the ceremonies that took place there in Stockholm. And he invited me to go along, also with a number of other guests. So I had a wonderful time. It was really a once-in-a-lifetime experience. I was able to attend, as a member of the audience, the Nobel lectures in chemistry. I went to the Nobel Museum and took in some of the history of previous winners, and it's a wonderful place to visit if you've never been there. I also went to the Nobel Prize-giving ceremony, which happens every year on the day that Alfred Nobel died, on December 10th. In addition to the prize-giving ceremony, there was a wonderful banquet that followed, and we were there dining with about 1,300 other people, including the King and Queen of Sweden, and all the royalty, and many dignitaries.
Wow. I mean, that's incredible. That's truly a once-in-a-lifetime experience.
It was really a thrilling time, and the pageantry was just beautiful. Out of this world, really. It's hard to describe, but it was really a celebration of humanity and the best of humanity in the arts and sciences and really in every dimension. So I had a great time in Stockholm.
That's excellent. So were you interested in the history of the Nobel Prizes before this all happened, or did this sort of spark your interest?
Well, certainly the Nobel Prize week and festivities in Stockholm did spark my interest. Previously, I didn't know much about the Nobel Prize or the history of the prize, but I found out about the rich history, which has been going on for over 100 years now. So that added to my interest about giving a talk in the symposium at the ACS meeting about women scientists who perhaps might have won Nobel Prizes, but didn't for one reason or another as a member of the history division. I thought that the particular symposium my talk was in might attract a good size audience and possibly lead to other opportunities in the future, in addition to giving the audience some information and hopefully a good story. I really enjoy in-depth research, and so this has been one way for me to delve into the library stacks and to scan the internet for interesting information, sometimes obscure information. It's really a kind of detective work, or sleuthing, as I like to say. And I had some confidence that I could put together an interesting talk. I decided to present on someone less well-known. Many of us can name some of the more well-known women scientists, but I thought, let me find out more about somebody who I could bring to the limelight and have fun researching. So I started gathering some information, enough to put together an abstract, and I learned that although Catherine Burr Blodgett was mainly a physicist, she considered herself a chemist by adoption. She adopted the field of chemistry. And in fact, her work was largely in the area of chemistry, and in particular, physical chemistry, especially her work on thin films and the building up of monolayers into multilayers. She continued that work for many years, at first under the direction of Irving Langmuir, who won a Nobel Prize in 1932, and later more on her own. She was really a forerunner in the science of nanotechnology, building up molecular structures in a systematic fashion. This particular topic of research took me into the chemistry of World War I and World War II, and some of the ways she participated in the development of agents like smoke screens and the development of charcoal for use in gas masks to capture toxic gases that were being used starting in World War I. It also took me into General Electric's history, and I learned about some of the personalities that were prominent in the 20s, 30s, and 40s.
That's very cool. I think, you know, people tend to often only think about chemistry in terms of what's happening now and bench work and research. And I think it's really great to be able to learn more about everything that, you know, came before us and helped us to get here.
She really had quite an interesting life. In addition to her science, she had interests in many other things outside of the laboratory, including bridge, gardening. Another of her interests was in community theater, which she did for many years.
For those who don't know about the work and life of Catherine Burr Blodgett, would you mind giving just a little bit of a summary of what you have learned about her and what you presented about her?
Catherine Burr Blodgett was born in 1898, and she lived until 1979. She was born and then died in Schenectady, New York. Now, her father had been working as a patent attorney at General Electric in Schenectady. Unfortunately, he was murdered by an intruder a few weeks before she was born. One result of that loss was that her mother took the two children to New York City and then later to France and to Germany, where they traveled and learned those languages as preparation for later in life. She came back to New York City then and was enrolled in a private school, a small school for girls, named Mrs. Raisins, because there were three Raisins sisters, and she graduated from that school and went on to Bryn Mawr College on a scholarship. There she majored in physics and encountered a mathematics professor and a physics professor who specialized in optics, and his name was Professor Barnes. She was greatly influenced by him and had decided around that time to go into a life of research. During her senior year at Bryn Mawr, she had the opportunity to visit General Electric, where her father had worked, and she was given a tour of the facilities by Irving Langmuir. He told her at that time that she would probably need to further her education before working on the scientific staff at GE. So she goes to the University of Chicago and in 1 year earns a master's of physics. She goes back then to General Electric and joins Irving Langmuir as one of his assistants. Then after working on thin films and tungsten filaments for light bulbs for several years. He encouraged her to obtain a higher degree, and she went over to the University of Cambridge and worked with Rutherford and obtained her PhD in 2 years and graduated the first woman physics PhD student from Cavendish Laboratory at the University of Cambridge. So upon going back to General Electric, she was fully on the staff of the research department as their first woman scientist. And more and more she was working on her own, building up multi-layers of thin films based on Langmuir's monolayer technology. And she eventually found that these multi-layers, mainly made of long-chain fatty acids, could be made to be non-reflective. And so this was the beginning of non-reflective glass. She was able to figure out a system of measuring the thickness of very thin films. And these were on the order of several angstroms.
You say you were able to give a 25-minute lecture kind of about Catherine Burb Lodgett. And I hear that you actually turned this into an opportunity to present as Catherine Burb Lodgett. Can you talk a little bit about how you made that decision and what that experience was like?
As I was doing research over a period of months, I began more and more to identify with my character of Catherine Burb Lodgett. And the reasons for that were she had a love of experimental science, a love of the outdoors. I noticed a certain persistence in her career and in her experimentation. She worked closely with a mentor, and I came to appreciate her originality. Because of my identification with her, at least in some of these ways, it dawned on me that I might be able to present as if I were Dr. Blodgett. That would give me a chance to connect with the audience and even interact a bit. So I gave it a try after checking with the chair of the division and the symposium coordinator, and they essentially said, go for it. Although I did not don a costume or make my hair gray or anything like that, I did act as though I was Dr. Blodgett, and it gave me a certain freedom to interpret her role. My nature is usually more reserved, but I find if I put on a hat, so to speak, of another character, it gives me more freedom to act out and be a bit more theatrical. And so I did experience that I had more freedom to connect with the audience, to make a few jokes, to make it a little bit interactive. And so I think overall it worked well. And I had a few comments afterwards to that effect. And I would try it again.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it sounds like it was very memorable, especially how you stayed in character during the questions at the end as well.
Yeah, we had some fun with that. And the audience went along and treated me as if I were in character.
So when people would ask you questions that maybe you didn't know the answer to, how would you handle that? How did that go?
Yeah, good question. I did have one question from the audience, which was, did Catherine Burb Lodgett really contribute to the Nobel Prize of Irving Langmuir in 1932? I had to stop and think about that because actually most of the work that led him to being awarded that prize had been done previously. Although that his work continued and my character contributed many experiments that helped, I think, round out the research. And he even mentioned her in his Nobel acceptance speech as having contributed greatly. But really, Dr. Blodgett did not hit her stride until maybe the late 30s and early 40s when she was really on her own more of the time doing experiments. So in terms of your question, I just used what I knew and gave some answer like that.
So, you know, that kind of on that same topic, with everything you've learned about her and her role in the development of Langmuir, do you feel like she should have also received the Nobel Prize, or are you unsure?
I'm unsure after all. So in that sense, I did not make a very good case for her being overlooked for a Nobel Prize. Nevertheless, her work was quite original, and she was a pioneering scientist in her own right.
That's a very interesting point as well. I know Nobel's, it's, you know, also so much about timing. And perhaps if she had been working on this on this project a little earlier in her career and in Langmuir's career, maybe things would have been a little different.
Yeah, that's right. And she was younger than he was, and even though she started working at General Electric at age 20 after completing her master's degree in physics, he had already laid down a lot of his ideas in two major papers, one on liquids and one on solids, before she came along. And then there were the war years when they were working on projects of national defense, both during World War I and World War II. And so that work in particular is not so widely known because they presumably turned in government reports that were not published elsewhere. So that might be an area to investigate further.
Yeah, that's very interesting and definitely not something I have thought about before about wartime chemistry, as you've said, and sort of how the priorities of research must have shifted in those eras. In your research, did you come across any indication of hardship that she faced trying to forge a career in science being a woman during that time period?
Yes, she faced some difficulties. The culture at General Electric in the 20s, 30s, and 40s was really male-oriented. There was a club of men working at GE who were the technical gurus, and it was exclusively male. And they also had a retreat place up on a lake that was limited to members of the male club. There was a women's club that formed, and she was active in it for many years, being treasurer and I think eventually president. And that gave women kind of an outlet to, you know, conduct social discussions and get to know one another. She was not recognized by being promoted, although eventually she did have an opportunity to serve as a mentor to other male scientific staff.
I can't imagine how difficult it must have been to really be forging a path in such a male-dominated field at that time. I think it's a real testament to her character, how successful she was in that.
I think it must have been quite difficult. At the same time, she developed many other interests in the community, so it sounds like she had a well-rounded life.
Speaking of diverse interests and careers in science, it looks like you've had quite an interesting one. It looks like you've worked in industry and cancer research as well as teaching before your current position. Could you talk a little bit about the variety of experiences you've had?
I grew up in New Jersey, and I got interested in biology during high school, and I had a wonderful teacher and mentor at the time, Mr. Charles Waters. And so as a result of that interest, I started majoring in college at William & Mary in biology, but pretty soon switched over to a chemistry major. It was a wonderful program. I got an excellent education at William & Mary and then went directly over to Northwestern University for graduate school in chemistry. I was working in research on DNA synthesis, which was kind of primitive at the time, and we were developing the chemistry to put oligonucleotides together. Well, I did finish my PhD in organic chemistry and moved on to take a job in Midland, Michigan at Dow Chemical. There, I was working in biotechnology, synthesizing DNA, and moved into working with the chemical modification of antibodies. This was part of Dow Chemical's central research department at the time. After 9 years there, I took a position actually in a similar field at the National Cancer Institute, which is a part of the National Institutes of Health. And I learned more about cancer immunology, took some courses, and I was a member of an 80-person group working on tumor immunology and biology. After 5 years at the NIH, I went down the street to Georgetown University and worked at the Lombardi Cancer Center in an analytical biochemistry laboratory. Well, at that point, my career took a real turn, and I joined a religious order, which I eventually left, but this was an order of Dominican sisters based in Wisconsin. And in addition to obtaining a degree in theology during that period, I also taught chemistry at one of their universities called Dominican University in River Forest. And I taught chemistry, general chemistry, and organic and chemistry in society, things like that, for about 5 years. I had decided to leave Dominican University and get a fresh start. And during a period of unemployment, I learned that Sir Fraser Stoddart would be coming to Northwestern from UCLA, and he was joining the faculty, and that he was looking for a PhD chemist to assist him in the office. The way I learned about this opportunity was through networking at regional and national ACS meetings. And so I was able to interview with him in the fall of 2007, and he decided to hire me. And both of us started here at Northwestern in January of 2008. So we've been here close to 10 years, and we've come to work very well together.
I didn't realize that you've been working with him for his entire tenure at Northwestern. That's really cool.
I had to learn a lot about the administrative workings of a university and how to create and upload grant proposals and create budgets and many things having to do with money, which for me, at least in a work context, was pretty much foreign. So I've come a long way, mastered many of the skills, and I have some creative opportunities to think about chemistry, especially when I'm interacting with the young people and listening to their talks.
It's so interesting to hear such a varied career path, especially now you being in sort of a non-traditional in terms of, you know, people think of either going into industry or going into academia. So it's really interesting to hear about some of the other options available for PhD chemists to be involved in the chemistry and as well as the history of the field. This is sort of a cheesy question. It's okay if you don't have a good answer for it, but, you know, do you have any advice for people, you know, just kind of starting their careers in chemistry and wondering, considering all of these different options between academia, industry, alternative careers, and sort of what's your advice for navigating all of those career options?
I would say keep an open mind, maybe go with a position if there are offers forthcoming, and just think of it as staying for a few years or 4 or 5 years. It doesn't have to be a career path written in stone. You can learn things. Whatever is gained will be useful for you in the future, and you can use it as a stepping stone. I think we're really past the period of time when individual chemists would go to a company, for example, and stay for their entire career. It can happen, and does sometimes, but more often we're moving around every several years.
Well, I think that's really great advice and very encouraging, you know, hear about having the confidence to try different things and know that your career can always move forward from there. Thank you so much for talking with me today. It's been fascinating to learn about your own experience as well as history of Catherine Burr-Blodgett and the Nobel Prize. So thank you again.
Okay, Liz, thank you for the opportunity. I've enjoyed it.
And that's it for this episode of the Sustainable Nano Podcast. Thanks very much again to Dr. Margaret Schott for interviewing with us. Thanks to Liz Laudadio for doing the interview. Thank you, as always, to the National Science Foundation, which provides funding for the Center for Sustainable Nanotechnology, the producer of this podcast. As always, we have our disclaimer that the opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the speakers and not necessarily those of the National Science Foundation. This was our last episode for the year 2017. We will be coming back after winter break with more episodes on themes of nanotechnology, sustainability, and life in science. Do you want more in the meantime? We want to hear from you on Twitter and Facebook. We're at Sustainable Nano, all one word. You can catch up on all our previous podcast episodes at podcast.sustainable-nano.com. You can also read over 200 blog posts that we've written from the Center for Sustainable Nanotechnology, most of them by graduate students in the center, and our blog address is sustainable-nano.com. Have a great winter break, and we'll see you in 2018.